history has shown us that these world leaders are doing very little to actually reduce emissions. They're more interested in creating capitalist markets that save the economy as opposed to reduce emissions and save the planet. And it's going to be us putting pressure on them, not the solutions that they're negotiating inside.
It's already clear from the G20 summit in Italy that no matter what is agreed at COP26, global temperatures will continue to rise, affecting some communities more than others.
Failed climate policy that's existing right now that the world needs to know is on the backs of our indigenous peoples. It's going to devastate our food systems, our rising systems, our culture.
6 years since the landmark Paris Climate Accord, and the stakes have never been higher. And these protesters say we can't have our leaders cop out now. Saeed Purizza, Glasgow.
Meet Perkinra, an all-Iranian drug for treating rheumatoid arthritis in children. The drug is a new formulation of Anakinra, or what is internationally known as Kineret, which is a product of a Swedish pharmaceutical company. Iranian biotech firm Persisgen says Perkinra is the first Iranian biopharmaceutical medication that is developed from A to Z inside Iran.
The medicine had been tested on patients under 16 who needed intensive care in Tehran's Imam Hussein Hospital, where hospitalization rates had reduced by 65% after the clinical trial. He said half of the patients who avoided the medicine during the trial had died, while those taking the medication had seen their oxygen levels improve after 48 hours.
In rheumatoid arthritis, or shortly RA, the immune system attacks healthy cells in the body by mistake, causing painful swelling in the joints. In Iran, around 500,000 people are suffering from the condition. They get weekly injections of Kineret, the Swedish drug, which is highly unavailable in Iran due to U.S. sanctions that prevent the country from paying for foreign medicine.
By producing this medicine, Persisgen managed to break the monopoly of Sweden on the production of RA drugs. Plus, the import of the drug takes a complicated procedure given the fact that foreign companies shy away from selling medicine to Iran due to fear from U.S. punishment. And even if they want to, Iran cannot pay them because of the banking sanctions.
Persisgen says it has so far manufactured 60,000 syringes of Perkinra for distribution in the Iranian market. At the same time, it has initiated exports to three countries of Ukraine, Turkey, and the Philippines.
Prompted by years of U.S. sanctions that have blocked Iranians' access to life-saving medicine, Iran has been trying to gain self-sufficiency in the pharmaceutical sector. And this biotech firm says Perkinra is a byproduct of that pressure, which will now obviate the need for Iranian RA patients to desperately wait for foreign medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, got into trouble in May 2018 when then-US President Donald Trump unilaterally abandoned it and reimposed sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In January this year, when Trump's successor, Joe Biden, took office, he expressed willingness to return to the deal. Accordingly, Tehran and the remaining JCPOA parties, namely China, Russia, the UK, France, and Germany, began talks in Vienna in April. Six rounds of negotiations were held before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. Now, Iran's foreign minister has questioned that whether the US is serious to return to the JCPOA.
If there is a serious will in Washington to return to the deal, there is no need for all these negotiations at all. It is enough for the US president to issue an executive order tomorrow and announce that the US is joining the pact from the point where the Trump administration left.
On Friday, the US imposed fresh sanctions targeting Iran's drone program, a move drawing a reaction from the Iranian Foreign Ministry.
The imposition of new sanctions reflect the completely contradictory behavior of the White House, an administration that talks about returning to the JCPOA and is following the same methods of the Trump administration by imposing sanctions, is sending a message that it is not trustworthy at all.
Iran's drone program, along with its missile program, is among issues that the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies say must be included in talks over the JCPOA. That's what Iran has time and again rejected, saying its defense program remains non-negotiable.
Iran's defense capability is a matter of national decision that is intertwined with the country's national interests and security. Therefore, no country has the right to speak or comment on this issue.
Iran says it is interested in continuing the Vienna talks, but the negotiations must be result-oriented and lead to the removal of the sanctions in a verifiable manner. However, the White House persists in exerting pressure on Iran to speed up the talks, a policy that Russia believes is unhelpful.
Pressure on Iran to speed up the experience shows that it doesn't help. Either you do it bilaterally or in the commission, or you do it through the IAEA.
Top officials within the Biden administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, have admitted that the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by Trump against Iran has failed. However, despite the admission, the White House seems to be still following up that proven failed policy.
Tens of thousands of Palestinians are lining up in front of the Chambers of Commerce across the Gaza Strip, hoping to get permits from the Israeli side to walk in the occupied lands and the West Bank. This comes after Ramers saying that more permits are set to be issued for the first time following the recent escalation on the Gaza Strip.
It is hard to believe that Israel is going to issue permits for us to work in occupied lands and the West Bank. Since 2019, no permission has been issued by Israel. We have been jobless since then. Now Israel says it is going to issue new permits, but it has set hard conditions for us.
In light of the deteriorating economic situation in Gaza with the high unemployment rate of more than 53% and poverty reaching about 70%, Palestinians hope to obtain the permits to find work opportunities in the occupied lands and the West Bank that will help them to reduce their poverty. Since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, it no longer allowed Gaza workers to obtain permits that would enable them to work, as tens of thousands of workers used to go out daily to work in the occupied lands as their only source of income in the fields of construction, agriculture, industry, and tourism.
The Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip has led to an unprecedented level of unemployment in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, about 70% of Palestinian families suffer from lack of food, and this is all due to the collapse of Gaza's economy.
The Chamber of Commerce says Israel should be held accountable for the growing rate of unemployment in Gaza.
The daily hardships endured by Palestinians, along with the crippling blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, led thousands to search for work opportunities outside Gaza. Palestinians called on the international community to end the siege and develop solutions to reduce high rates of poverty and unemployment. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
There should be solidarity both in words and action. The affairs of a sector might be interrelated with many other sectors. Your agricultural sector is naturally connected with a few other sectors. There should be cooperation so that the task in hand will be accomplished properly. The same is true of the industrial and many other sectors. So, solidarity is necessary so as to accomplish the task. Having strength is necessary as well. The administration should know that it has the power to carry out its plans and its decisions. It should not be the case that people feel there is a state of abandonment. If you do not show governmental power in practice, and if individuals witness a state of abandonment, your policies will certainly not move forward. This is important. As for mastery, it means that you should be aware of all the details in the administration. Therefore, the administration should carry out its duties with power, solidarity, and complete mastery. And this is part of the endeavor to bring about transformation in the judiciary branch.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of Mr. Raisi's plans and those of other presidential candidates was to bring about transformation in the executive branch. A transformation in the executive branch is an important endeavor. This transformation is a perpetual need which should always be placed within sight. Of course, a transformation directed towards progress depends on relying on the law, enhancing transparency, having financial discipline, destroying the roots of corruption, preventing a clash of interests, and being serious in implementing decisions and bills. Of course, it is very important to rejuvenate the administration. The rejuvenation of the administration is an important task for the administration. You should employ youth as much as you want in the body of the administration and in mid-management positions, as we thankfully have no shortage of skilled youth. This will extinguish the feeling of hopelessness in the country. When the youth see that they can enter the arena and make decisions, there will be no feeling of hopelessness in the country.
Allah, limelight.
The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves, says Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist, in an article titled West Throws Palestinian Rights Groups to the Wolves. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's criminalization of Palestinians resisting foreign domination did not begin with the recent order declaring six prominent groups terror organizations. This dangerous development is only the logical outcome of decades of impunity and repression against any Palestinian assembly that challenges the Zionist regimes of apartheid, occupation, and colonization. One of the groups targeted by the Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz's terror designation order is Al-Hab, which was founded in 1979 and is one of the oldest Arab human rights organizations. Raja Shahada, one of the organization's founders, recounts in the New York Review of Books that the Zionist regime has persistently tried to discredit Al-Haq and his work. In his early years, this meant labeling Al-Haq a front for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which the Zionist regime outlawed before the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1990s. In 1980, the Zionist regime troops, suspicious of cars parked nearby, raided the group's offices during a meeting attended by an Amnesty International representative. Shahada stated in The Guardian recently, "When we lodged the complaint, the army began an interminable investigation of the incident, which after many years was still not concluded." It is but one example of the repression endured by Palestinians as all forms of collective organizing around their rights are treated by the Zionist regime as a security threat. Now, the Zionist regime is applying a draconian 2016 anti-terror law for the first time, accusing Al-Haq and five other groups of operating as covert arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance organization. That group is banned by the Zionist regime as well as the US and the EU because it refuses to go along with the Oslo Accord surrender, refuses to recognize the fake regime of Israel and renounce armed resistance. International law recognizes the legitimacy of armed struggle in anti-colonial and anti-occupation struggles against foreign domination. Criminalizing resistance groups like PFLP serves the oppressor. The Zionist regime has repeatedly jailed lawmaker and human rights defender Khalida Jarrar based on her membership with the PFLP without meaningful protest from Washington and Brussels. Governments have criminalized the Palestinian Movement for National Liberation by designating PFLP and other factions that reject normalization with their oppressor as terror organizations. Meanwhile, Palestinian human rights groups and other organizations have to divert resources from their core work to fulfill onerous auditing requirements to receive European funding. These conditions, first imposed by U.S. government agencies and private foundations, have increasingly restricted the work of Palestinian groups. Palestinian organizations must deal with funders' increased demands as the Zionist regime arrests their workers, raids their offices, and prevents staff from traveling abroad or between the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, the U.S. and EU lavish the Zionist regime with weapons and grants to develop repression technology field-tested on Palestinian bodies. The hypocrisy and double standards are mind-boggling. While banning Palestinian resistance groups, Washington flouts U.S. law that prohibits the government from assisting units of foreign militaries when there is credible information that those units violated human rights with impunity. Al-Haq leads the way in monitoring and documenting those human rights violations and advocating to burst the Zionist regime's bubble of impunity at the international level. Al-Haq and two other groups targeted by the Zionist regime's war ministry, Adamir and Defense for Children International Palestine, have filed evidence of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Benny Gantz is likely being investigated by the court for his military chief and war ministry roles in 2014 and 2021 assaults on Gaza, during which the Zionist regime Air Force bombed civilian towers and obliterated entire families in their homes. As Al-Haq founder Raja Shahada observes, Gantz's terror group order is likely to be followed by one from the Zionist regime's military commander in the West Bank. That would mean that anyone working for any of the six targeted groups or providing services or expressing support for them will be subject to arrest on terrorist charges. Shahada adds, the organization's financial assets will be confiscated and the Israeli regime banks will stop any funding from reaching it. Barring significant international pressure on the Zionist regime, in 2 months, there won't be a Palestinian civil society, according to Obay Al-Aboudi, director of Bisson Center for Research and Development, one of the targeted groups. When the Zionist regime moves to starve Palestinian groups of the funding necessary to carry out their international advocacy work, its powerful international friends have sought to undermine accountability at The Hague. Their toothless statements of concern over the terror group designations must be understood in the context of their willingness to help the Zionist regime evade justice. It took Canada a week to acknowledge the Zionist regime's attack on the Palestinian groups while stating no position against it. In true settler state solidarity with the Zionist regime, Canada made thinly veiled threats to withdraw funding in a letter to the court stating its opposition to an ICC investigation in the West Bank and Gaza last year. Canada also paved the way for the siege on Gaza, now in its 15th year, by boycotting the elected Hamas government and cutting aid to the Palestinian Authority, citing the group's refusal to recognize the fake regime of Israel and give up Palestinians' right to armed resistance. Ottawa restored funding to the PA a year and a half later after the Western-backed Fatah Party, led by Mahmoud Abbas, seized control of the West Bank, leaving Gaza isolated and forsaken. In Washington, the Biden administration has voiced no protest against the terror group designations. The only government-level pushback has been a draft resolution signed on by a handful of House representatives. The draft resolution upholds the courageous work being done by the six Palestinian civil society organizations defending the human rights of a vulnerable and at-risk Palestinian population living under Israeli regime military occupation. But many more members of Congress on both sides of the political aisle signed on to a letter drafted by the Zionist regime lobby giant AIPAC, supporting the Trump administration's efforts to sabotage the International Criminal Court's probes into war crimes in Palestine and Afghanistan.
These efforts included placing economic sanctions on Fatou Bensouda, the former chief prosecutor whose term ended in June, placing her in the company of international terrorists and drug traffickers. Though it has lifted the sanctions, the Biden administration has quietly attempted to pressure the Palestinian Authority into dropping the case at the International Criminal Court. Yet another green light to the Zionist regime to continue to build settlements in violation of international law and kill scores of Palestinians with U.S. weapons without consequence. The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves. The Zionist regime informed the EU embassy in Tel Aviv in advance of its intentions to designate Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations. The EU failed to relay this information to member states, some of which have pushed back against the Israeli regime's move. EU spokesperson Peter Stano told the electronic Intifada that we will be engaging Israeli authorities for more information regarding the basis for these designations. It is a statement of total deference to what human rights groups based in occupied territories have called an act of cowardice characteristic of repressive authoritarian regimes.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's been described as an abortive act of piracy. The IRGC Navy has foiled the U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, but why would the U.S. do that? Maybe it's because it does not want Iran to sell or deliver its oil to anyone. But Iran has been warning for years that the U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf is a source of instability. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the ramifications of this illegal act by the U.S.
We are conducting the operation.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps released a video on Wednesday which showed how its naval force foiled a recent U.S. attempt to steal a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. The IRGC said the Americans seized a tanker and transferred its cargo to another vessel to divert it to an unknown destination. The IRGC forces, however, managed to land on the deck of the second tanker and diverted it into Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces unsuccessfully attempted to block the tanker's path using helicopters and warships. They also made another failed attempt to seize the tanker from entering the Iranian waters. The ship later docked in Bandar Abbas port on October the 25th.
This is an American invasion, a hostile action against Iranian interests. This would definitely escalate the tensions, but the purpose of such moves is very much clear. As Iran has been practicing resistance diplomacy to resist against the United States pressures, illegal sanctions.
The U.S. has been trying to prevent Iran from selling its oil since former President Donald Trump pledged to bring the country's crude exports to zero. This toes the lines of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Trump launched in 2018 following his unilateral withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. Last year, the Trump administration also threatened to deploy the U.S. Navy to the Caribbean Sea to stop Iran from delivering fuel shipments to Venezuela, but it failed to do so. Recently, when Iran began exporting fuel to Lebanon, the U.S. again vowed to impede the effort, but to no avail. Iran has time and again warned against U.S. adventurism in the West Asian region. Iranian officials say Tehran does not seek to get involved in a conflict with Washington, but will give a firm and crushing response to any military action. The recent confrontation in the Sea of Oman has highlighted Iran's military might and conveyed a message to the White House that the Iranian armed forces will not hesitate to defend the country and its interests.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Tim Anderson, Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. And also joining us is John Bustich, Journalist and Political Analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Anderson, let me first start with you. and get your reaction to this U.S. provocation in the Sea of Oman and U.S.'s attempt to steal an Iranian oil tanker.
Well, basically, we're often talking about the same theme when we talk about so-called American sanctions, which is actually, in strict legal terms, just high seas piracy. The United States does not have the legal power to seize cargo between two sovereign states on the high seas. The United States, however, operates as if it were some kind of a high seas sheriff that's appointed itself to bounty hunt the economic products of countries that it wants to put under political pressure. Obviously, Iran has no reason to submit to this kind of high seas terror pressure, and is doing the right thing by continuing to conduct its independent trade policy.
But it's confusing as to why, A, the U.S. would feel that way, and B, why it would go to the extent that it did in terms of what happened today. I mean, when we take a look at the confrontational nature between Iran and the U.S., given obviously not only their past, but also in that strategic waterway, doesn't it risk that escalating to an all-out war?
So I understand where you're coming from, because you're coming from the position of the average normal person who anticipates and who actually usually expects that two sides in a dispute both have legitimate interests at stake and are just arguing about the relative legitimacy of their interest. That is not the situation in this case. Naturally, Iran has its sovereign interests of conducting business internationally. However, the United States, and I often refer to it not as the United States, but as the Anglo-American Empire, is merely carrying on the tactics and the policies of the English Empire, which used this kind of provocation to encourage destabilization and to cause problems, allowing them to assert authority where there was none. And it's not a surprise that the Union Jack and the pirate flag, the Jolly Roger, were often stocked on the same boat, which in the daytime was serving as the English Navy ship, and at the nighttime was a pirate ship on the King's Commission. This is no different from history, and I don't understand why people can't remember our most recent past and apply it to today's events. This is the main issue here.
Okay. Tim Anderson, welcome. Looking at what has happened, first, let me get an idea from you, your reaction as to what Iran has said was this effort for piracy from the U.S.
Yes, well, I don't want to speculate on what was really behind this particular incident. It's not clear yet from the information why they would have done this, except I want to comment on the current situation of the U.S., which I believe is in a time of uncertainty where there's a partial strategic withdrawal from the region going on.
Looks like we lost Tim Anderson. So let me turn to you, John Bosnich. So, Tim Anderson, if you're back with us, go ahead, continue.
Sorry. So I was saying that at this time, there are certain changes happening in the Biden administration, and on one side it has Israel with a fair degree of anxiety that the Biden administration may withdraw from the region. That's its main concern. And Israel has already, the Israeli leaders have already said to the Biden administration they should provoke Iran, they should go harder. Of course, Israelis don't want to do it themselves. They want the U.S. to carry out some sort of strike there. At the same time, the Biden administration has been talking about reverting to having its consulate in Jerusalem with a Palestinian brief, because they're trying to keep alive the myth of two states, which is important to keep the liberal Zionists in on the picture there. At the same time, they've withdrawn from Afghanistan. They're reconsidering their situation in Syria and Iraq. And so it's a time of uncertainty for the Biden administration. I think this act today really was a blow to the morale and the prestige of the U.S. military in the region. And I think that may have an impact on the uncertainty and the contemplation of a partial strategic withdrawal.
What would U.S. officials who have spoken on the condition of anonymity say that The Iranian report was not true, and there had been no American attempt to seize a tanker, Tim Anderson.
Well, it's routine that they deny these sorts of things. I think that I've seen some video of what appears to be a pursuit, but I can't comment on the detail, but it's absolutely routine that the US would deny these things. They denied, after all, that anyone was hurt in Al-Assad Air Base strike in early 2020, and later on we heard there was more than 100 that had concussive injuries from that, so I wouldn't take that too seriously.
Okay, John Bostinger, I guess Tim Anderson talks about Israel and the U.S. and what Israel wants the U.S. to do, which is something that Israel is not going to do, and that is to have the U.S. provoke Iran and then get into a military engagement, which I'm assuming that Israel may follow through after the U.S. commits itself militarily to Iran. Both have made threats against Iran. How do you view that in the context of what happened today?
Well, I mean, in the context of bad events, one could take minimal reassurance in the fact that Israel does not feel that it could get away with making a unilateral attack on Iran and surviving the PR blowout as a result. So, to whatever extent it has any value, the slow movement on the part of the United States to do Israel's dirty work by bombing Iran or in other ways attacking Iranian interests is acting as a potential break to a much more severe conflict. And I do not see a coalition of the willing taking shape here. I do not see a clamoring on the part of other countries to assist the United States and Israel on this pressure against
Why
Iran. And I think that, I think that people have wisened up. After the war on Iraq for non-existent weapons of mass destruction, after identical unproven claims against Iran, after interventions in eastern Ukraine, in the Donbass region, I think that the American people are getting a bit tired of war without end and war without cause. War without cause. And it's revealing more and more that the wars are not made in the interests of the people of any country, but they are made in the interest of the war-driven economy, the military-industrial complex, which simultaneously owns the media that tells the people what to think. And this is all part of an ecosystem, and at today's time and date, Iran is the target. That's how the system works, unfortunately for all of us.
Tim Anderson, the U.S. has time and again said that we do not want nor will allow the Iranian oil to go out into the market, whether Iran is going to deliver it, sell it, or in any form. It has issued warnings against Iran on that, and we know that simply when it came to delivering oil to Venezuela, if you recall, and more recently to Lebanon. And this is under the sanctions that it has imposed, but also under that U.S. maximum pressure campaign. But we see that that sanction has been broken by Iran. Why does the U.S. insist to pursue that route when it has failed?
Well, you're right to point out that there's a great deal of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration. In the Trump tore up the nuclear deal and proceeded into what he called this maximum pressure situation, which is effectively, of course, it's not sanctions at all. It's an economic siege. It's a blockade. It's grossly illegal. But, of course, those examples you mentioned, the oil to Venezuela, and Venezuela, by the way, its oil industry is recovering very strongly now as a result of that. The oil to Lebanon was not blocked, so the maximum pressure campaign might be there in words, but it's leaking very strongly. And remember that the U.S. had to create some new leaks in its campaign to allow the so-called Arab gas pipeline to come in as an alternative to Iranian oil from Jordan through Syria into Lebanon. So the U.S. was forced to back down in a number of those things. As I say, I think it's important because there is a strategic rethinking going on at the moment, which I believe began under the Trump administration, and Biden followed through with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. But the withdrawal from Afghanistan has consequences. It's weakened the U.S. hand against Iran, for one thing, because the Taliban, whatever we think of them, has worked to have a better relationship with Iran and a better relationship with China, and that's worked against U.S. strategic interests there. And Israel's relationship with the Biden administration is now under some strain. There's a fair degree of anxiety and shrillness coming from the Israeli side about what they would like to do. They'd like the U.S. to maintain its forces in the region when it's thinking to withdraw them, and they would like the U.S. to provoke Iran and do dirty work that the Israelis haven't got the stomach to do themselves.
John Message, I'm curious as to what the U.S. and Israel think when it comes to Iran's military might. I mean, you know, Iran is not the same Iran that it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, or even a few years back. There's been lots of advances that Iran has made in the military arena, from its naval capabilities to its air force, to even its forces on the ground. I mean, the U.S. war on Syria, along with its allies, in a sense, helped Iran in terms of its role that it played in fighting the Daesh terrorists. Does that figure in their calculations when they see the way that Iran has increased its capabilities, including the way that it handled the situation today?
Indeed it does work into their calculations, but it works into their calculations in two ways. Number one, they use it as grounds to claim more money from their government and from their taxpayers to even greater expand American military power. If you get out of your head the idea that the governments of the world work in the interests of all the people in every country in the world, and that there are governments that do not do that, and they work in the interests of special interests, then you realize that Iran's buildup of its self-defense mechanisms is used to buy more weapons in the United States. But on the second side of the same coin, it does make a difference in the region, especially insofar as Israel appears to no longer believe it has the independent capacity to strike out against Iran by itself. So Iran's defense buildup has had the dampening factor on regionally led strikes that draw the United States into a conflict. So this is a beneficial defensive advancement on Iran's side.
Tim Anderson, we do have to talk about the region itself, this Persian Gulf region, the strategic waterway of the Strait of Hormuz, where you have a lot of oil pass through it. Iran has time and again throughout the years stated that, you know, we can handle the security in the region. And Iran says that not just us, but to involve regional countries in West Asia to participate in establishing that security, and pointing to the U.S. as being a source of instability. If the U.S. is a source of instability, if you agree, then shouldn't the U.S. leave this region alone? It says it's in its plans to remove itself from West Asia, unless that's not the case.
Well, in an ideal world, of course, they should get completely out of West Asia. But I think in terms of the plan that they've been trying to pursue for the last 20 years at least, or a bit more really, they are realizing that there's a series of losing wars in which they're engaged, and the question is what to do about that. And the notion that I mentioned, the idea of a partial strategic withdrawal, which has been spoken of for at least 5 years in the US, and Trump tried a bit of it and didn't work, and Biden pursued it with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the direct occupation withdrawal from Afghanistan. This all figures into a strategic positioning of the U.S. because, of course, let's remember, they are also seriously overextended as regards China. So they're trying to maintain this barrier between Russia and Europe. They're fighting a series of losing wars in West Asia, and they're making these provocative steps against China and threatening a war over Taiwan. Now, this is a serious overextension. And it's not that the U.S. administrators are stupid. They will be aware of this, and they'll be thinking about ways in which to deal with it. And the way that they typically deal with it is to palm it off to their so-called partners, that is to say their subordinate characters in the region. And this is what's been spoken on in West Asia. They can say, if we withdraw from Syria and Iraq, we will allow Erdogan in the north and the Saudis to fight over control of Syria and Iraq. Supposedly, that's still part of their game plan there, basically. The Israelis factor into that, and the Israelis, let's remember, are also in the Persian Gulf now. They're increasing their presence in the Emiratis. They're putting their media outfit into the UAE. They have a presence in North Iraq. They have a strong presence in Azerbaijan. In other words, Erbil on the edge of Iran and Azerbaijan on the north. There is an Israeli presence in the Gulf and on in the north and the northwest of Iran now. So they'll be counting on that in a way to try and pursue whatever assets they have left in the region to carry on the work that they've failed to do in the last 20 years. And that, of course, includes Daesh, the ISIS, the version of Daesh that was set up and which they've been using in Afghanistan with terrible effects since they withdrew.
So what about that Council of the Willing, John Bostich? Is there a will on the countries in this region to really foresee that a war against Iran is going to benefit the region? I mean, a country like the UAE, shouldn't it think twice?
Yes.
Especially given that Israel has penetrated into its intelligence apparatus. Did the UAE foresee any of this happening, as an example?
Once again, we are getting into this same problem of presuming that political and economic colony countries actually think for themselves. They don't. They receive a set of instructions from the leader of their particular alliance, and they follow the instructions. If they want to not come under kind of political pressure first, then economic sanctions like the ones that have been pursued against Iran for decades, or eventually military intervention. And this is the way the world is run today, and more people are understanding this. And this is the important, hopeful way out. The more the public understands that wars are contrived to make profit, and not created to defend national real interests in the region, the less likely it is that the United States can get any support from other countries except, of course, Israel. And that symbiotic relationship needs to come under more scrutiny, both in the United States and in Israel, because it's highly scrutinized now all around the rest of the world.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. That's John Bostich, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. Tim Anderson, a pleasure, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Damascus. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It was great having you. Until next time, I'm Kavitha. We see you then.